The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England,
world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Three people died in the chaos surrounding a gathering of white supremacists in Charlottesville, Virginia, last Saturday. In the week since, demonstrations against extremism have sprung up around the country, along with discussions of why white nationalism is on the rise 50 years after the civil rights movement. We've been wrestling with how to approach that here on Word of Mouth. We are well aware that we live in a majority white state, and there's a kind of self-consciousness that comes with being a majority white team, discussing race or understanding the experience of being the other. And that was the beginning of a conversation one afternoon about how it feels to be out of place, something that everyone has been through.
I mean, I'm uncomfortable a lot in general. I think I'm not always comfortable in my own skin or in most situations. But whenever I'm in a situation where there's a large group of people and then someone decides to say grace and people from both sides grab my hands and begin to pray, I never know what to do. I feel like my hands immediately start to sweat. I don't know where to look. I'm not religious, so I don't have anything to say, and I don't pray. And so oftentimes I sneak peeks at everybody else, and then I look down, and then I'll think about, like, wow, those Brussels sprouts look good.
When I was in college, I went to school in England for a couple of years, and I was in a small town called Arundel, England, and I was invited by the local Ladies' Garden Association to come to their party. And I had been told that fancy dress in England means costume, like you're dressing up in a costume. So I had been told that you would dress fancy for this. And I came basically to this garden party with all these ladies really in pearls and like Chanel suits dressed as Cher. It was kind of ridiculous. I mean, Cher with like clothing on, not just strings of sequins and feathers. And they all looked at me like this was how I dressed, and it was really embarrassing.
Mine was a crazy choice I made to write a long-form piece about cavers in New York, which are spelunkers, but they're like experienced spelunkers, and they call themselves cavers. And it was mostly middle-aged single men who would meet up at a bar in Midtown and then go upstate to go caving. And I spent like 2 months with them, and I was never remotely comfortable.
I've always felt out of place at gyms and gym-related spaces like locker rooms. I've always been like a skinny kid and probably had some body image issues related to that. So gyms always felt like a place where my body was especially noticeable to me.
Everybody knows that awkward feeling of displacement at some point in their life. We can all empathize with the inner cringe of drawing too much attention or feeling totally isolated and alone. And that's why most people gravitate toward places where they feel comfortable, surrounded by people who think or look like they do.
When I think about the spaces where I feel uncomfortable, it's me going into a space that I find uncomfortable, as opposed to, like, everything is uncomfortable and I have to go to a space to find refuge. And I only understand now a little better that for a lot of folks, that is a reversed dynamic, which has got to be really hard. Because I can not go into a gym.
Producers Taylor Quimby, Logan Shannon, Hannah McCarthy, and me sharing moments of gasping like fish out of water. Feelings of displacement run through descriptions of campus life for many people of color at the University of New Hampshire in Durham, where they still make up a tiny slice of the UNH student body. Following the presidential election of 2016, a series of racist incidents on campus made headlines, and students of color called upon the administration to make UNH a safer, more inclusive space. We sent producer Jimmy Gutierrez to follow up on how those demands have been handled. And he discovered a story that may sound familiar to many longtime New Hampshire residents.
Last year, there were close to 100 reported bias incidents at UNH. They included the vandalizing of school property with racial slurs and swastikas, while some students report having been spit on or having rocks thrown at them.
I have family from all over that are messaging me, like, are you okay? Like, what's going on your campus? Like, you know, and when we were meeting with administration, they just seemed so kind of nonchalant about the whole situation, and that's really, really frustrating.
This is Gabby Graves, and she's a senior at UNH. She helped organize a group of students that presented a list of 16 demands to the university's administration this past May. For this story, we're looking at one specific demand. It's a call for a cultural competency course that all students would be required to take before graduating. This includes raising awareness on the effects of implicit bias and stereotypes.
I think a course like that, one would inform students on how to learn about other cultures that aren't your own.
This also isn't the first time students have made a call for a class like this.
Hello, Chandra Craven speaking.
Hey, Chandra, this is Jimmy. How are you doing?
Good, how are you?
Chandra Craven went to UNH from 1995 through 99. She's originally from Boston and says she could go days on campus without seeing another person of color.
I don't think people quite understand it, but when you say it and you break it down and you say, one of 12 black females on a campus of 12,000 people, then they get it.
Chandra grew up navigating majority white spaces, but even that couldn't prepare her for some of the things she would hear at UNH.
I had a girl who came up to me and said, "What's wrong with your hands?" And I was like, "What are you talking about? What's wrong with my hand?" She goes, "Well, it's dark on one side and it's light on the other." And I said, "Excuse me?" Apparently, she had never met a person of color in real life. Those kind of questions just were a constant thing, and you never turn it off.
In the fall of 98, after repeatedly asking the university to address race relations, students from the Black Student Union staged a sit-in in then-President Joan Lutzel's office. They drafted a list of demands titled Broken Promises. This included a call for a cultural competency course.
That cultural competence wasn't just for the students to help us feel more comfortable on campus. It was also for leadership and for teachers. Because also, let's not forget, on the other end of that, we had maybe like 3 teachers of color on campus.
This past May, one of the tensest moments on campus came after a few students posted photos on their social media wearing ponchos and fake mustaches while joking about deportation. The issue of cultural appropriations, or distorting an oppressed group's culture, was also happening on campus in the 90s.
There's another nugget here that I think we need to get into. Sisters in STEP.
Oh, let's hit it. I knew you were going to take it there.
Sisters in STEP is a STEP group that was started at UNH by 3 women of color in the late 90s. Chandra was an original member.
If you look at STEP, it's a combination of hip-hop meets like traditional African call and response dance rhythm.
When Sisters in STEP started, it gave women of color a team of their own. A year later, the group decided to invite men of color to join. Today, people on campus say that the diverse group that started as a place of refuge has become an almost entirely white team. UNH students have even said that a few women of color were cut from the group at tryouts. Sisters in STEP didn't respond to our request for comment.
It hurts me to the very core of my being. I'm sorry, I'm going to cry here. Literally almost saved my life because I was at my wit's end being at UNH.
One administrator who's been on campus since the 90s remembers a different UNH.
A lot of people today will say, well, look, you didn't do this, you didn't do that. But having been there at the time, I can tell you that it really was a big push into the future.
Dean of Students, Ted Kirkpatrick, was on the receiving end of those demands in 98 and says the university has worked out a lot of those issues. In the late 90s, there were 2 African-American student body presidents. Representation for students of color on campus has jumped from 1% to 8%. But one demand that has not been met is a course on cultural competency.
From your point of view, what is the value of having a class like that? And would that class have made a difference if it would have been on campus for the last 20 years or so?
The answer to the last part of your question is absolutely.
Do you feel like the administration has done enough for students of color on this campus?
Never. I mean, even if we got A grades, the minute you get complacent, you're dead. So, no.
One difference with today's demands from those of 98 is that the dean himself is named.
The last demand is that I, if these things aren't done by the end of the coming academic year, that I'm replaced in my job as dean of students.
Kirkpatrick says there's still work to be done, and the administration is taking steps in the right direction.
This fall, we have a cluster hire of 3 African-American faculty. If you asked me to predict that last year, whoa, boy, the odds are long on that. Somehow they did it. White people did that.
UNH students on campus this fall will be working on these issues and waiting to see how the administration responds, even as many on campus don't see a problem.
Within like my peers, from like what I've noticed, they kind of think we're growing out of proportion. They don't see it as like a much larger issue that's been going on for decades.
Gabby Graves, like Chandra Craven, knows the effects of being a student of color at UNH. While she's battled depression, others have transferred or dropped out because of the campus's environment.
To have students come to like the university, have to deal with racism, homophobia, transphobia on a daily basis, and then still have to perform the same as like their counterparts who aren't dealing with those type of systematic interpersonal discriminatory like experiences, that is really difficult and it takes a huge toll on you mentally and emotionally.
The question facing all sides is whether or not students will be returning to a university that's ready to address these issues, or if this conversation will be passed down to another generation of students.
So I'm here with producer Jimmy Gutierrez, and he wanted to tell us about one of the people he met while reporting that story, but it is a voice that he had to leave out.
Yeah, I spoke to a mixed-race woman of color for the story who requested anonymity.
So she was cut from the news story, but you did meet her, you verified her identity. What do you want to tell us about her?
Well, she grew up here in New Hampshire, attended UNH in the late 90s, was an original member of Sisters in Step, even keeps up with today's students of color at UNH. And I'll just say from a news perspective, reporters usually agree to keep their sources anonymous if revealing their name could be dangerous in any way. It's also worth noting that talking about race isn't easy to do, especially if you already felt marginalized by the institutions that are there in place to keep you safe. So I fact-checked what I could, and after some discussion with our editors, we decided to air her story here separately.
All right. So for the purposes of this story, what should we call her?
We're calling her Melissa.
All right, Jimmy, let's hear it.
I remember celebrating Martin Luther King Day, and my mom would keep us home so that she could educate us about Martin Luther King Day. At that time, it wasn't a holiday in New Hampshire.
New England has long thought of itself as a progressive hub on lots of different fronts. But that doesn't mean the issue of race has always been handled well. New Hampshire was the last state to observe King by name with a holiday, and that didn't happen until the year 2000. That's when it replaced what was known as Civil Rights Day. For Melissa and her brother, they were two of three children of color in their elementary school. She remembers being called racial slurs by some of her friends. Even families that seemed welcoming made it clear they would have problems with her potentially dating their children.
And it's a lot to navigate in such a white space as New Hampshire was back then. People didn't understand how that was damaging to kids, I don't think.
After high school in the late 90s, Melissa went to the University of New Hampshire for college.
I wasn't super excited about it. I felt like a lot of people from my high school were going to UNH, and I wanted a change, and I wanted something different.
But she quickly found her footing and new friends. At the time, the school was on fire with racial politics. Melissa even got involved in the 98 sit-in. But it was a club where she says she found her sisters. Sisters in Step is a step group started on campus by three women of color, and that's where she found deep connection and acceptance.
We will not bow down to racism.
I started with them and I was, you know, horrible, horrible at it. Just really awful. And it was just so much generosity, you know, and sisterhood. And they really, like, spent a lot of time working with me. You know, I was in the back for a lot of performances. And I was just happy, you know, happy to be part of the team. And it was great.
Step is a combination of multiple styles, but primarily it's associated with hip-hop and call-and-response dance. It's also historically a part of Black culture. The group at UNH was started so that the 1% of women on campus could connect and have a space of their own. But over the past two decades, things have taken a turn for the group. Melissa and I pull up today's version of the group's Facebook page.
This is not what the team looked like when I was there. You know, it's mostly white faces, if not all, in these pictures. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it appears that they have the kind of sisterhood piece down, but it doesn't have the feeling of being a particularly diverse. And they've really, you know, destroyed what Sisters in Step meant to us. It's just clear, if you want to talk about appropriation, like, this is what appropriation is. You know, if you want to see it in action, this is it. Just kind of take something over and then edge out all of the people of color who want to be part of it.
Current UNH students have told Melissa that a few women of color had tried out for the group and were essentially cut, being told they weren't good enough. Sisters and Step didn't respond to our request for comment.
From my perspective, being probably, you know, the worst stepper possible, and I was still allowed to participate and still allowed to be in community and still allowed to, you know, share space.
After UNH, Melissa went into counseling and therapy, and she's got plenty of institutional knowledge with her experiences at UNH and growing up in New Hampshire. She says for the students at UNH, respectability politics, or going along to get along, has failed.
Over the last 20 years, I don't understand how you can know that students are being harmed and either not believe them or not think that it's as bad as it is. And I think it's a truly dangerous situation.
Today on the show, we're talking about race, a complex, densely layered part of America's history and present. And we're looking at what it takes to make more inclusive spaces or encourage conversations about race, especially in the part of the country known for liberalism, but not for diversity. That is something Russell Weatherspoon has thought about a lot in 40-plus years of teaching, 30 of those years in the religion department at Phillips Exeter Academy. Russell, thanks for coming in.
Thank you very much for the invitation.
So Phillips Exeter students have traditionally been white and come from very privileged families and backgrounds. Now, you are African American. Is race something that you talk about head-on with your students?
Yes, we do, because we have to, because young people care about that very much. And so, depending upon the period of time, what's going on in the broader landscape of the society, we will talk about it more as a collective community or less.
Now, you have a lot more diverse population of students now, right, than you did, I'm sure, 30 years ago.
It is more diverse than it was certainly 50 years ago. It was diverse when I got there 30 years ago. That is to say, in terms of the American population and also in terms of international students. And it is still more diverse, certainly, than much of this state. It has a little bit of a feel of a major city like New York or Chicago or Los Angeles.
So what has Phillips Exeter Academy been doing to make students feel safe and included?
Well, like all schools and colleges that have largely diverse populations, the school is aware that on the one hand, you need to provide opportunities for students to be able, if they choose, to be able to gather in affinity groups or to be in spaces where they can be free to speak about their concerns directly and in a place where they don't necessarily think they're going to be overheard by other people who are unsympathetic or are uncaring. I'm speaking principally about fellow students. You must, in your curriculum, have some place and space for their life. That is to say, if the curriculum moves along and the impression is that all of it is really about other groups, if they are not in the history or if they're not in the literature, et cetera, after a while it becomes clear that they are, they're not part of what's important. They're not part of what's valid. Of course, the students themselves, being young people, all of them, come there with whatever level of knowledge or lack of knowledge that they have about a wide variety of things. So in the natural course of things, people will say things to one another which are ignorant. I mean that in the simple sense of the word. That is to say, they are set out of a bank of not knowing. Or they will invite various members of underrepresented populations to speak as though they can be representative of the whole group. That tends to be irritating to people no matter who they are. Like any good school or college with a diverse population, you learn through experience, some of it hard, that you have to open up a variety of places and spaces so that such students can be not only feel safe, but so that the broader majority that knows very little about what it is like to be a member of those communities can learn without, how shall I say it, irritating.
Well, this is at a private school. People pay tens of thousands of dollars a year. It's a lot more internationalist. As you said, it's more like an urban space. But at UNH, current UNH students of color have insisted that a cultural competency course be required for all students. Now, this, as we found, is identical to a demand made to the administration almost 20 years ago. So given your experience as a teacher, what do you think the takeaway would be for those young, impressionable students?
Are you speaking about the young, impressionable students at UNH?
At UNH.
It's not surprising that that request would be made. It's a request that's being made up and down the land. It's even a request that's being made at Phillips Exeter. Again, it's part of the times in which we live. It grows out of the fact that legions of young people attending schools where they are significant minorities will find that they spend a lot of time explaining themselves or, again, being asked to speak authoritatively for the groups that they represent. They will listen to humor. They will listen to direct head-on insults. And they will go back to the administration and say, look, you need to take your responsibility. You've invited us here, which was great. You've made a space for us here. However, we are having an experience which feels like we are being put upon. I would think that any school or college that offers a cultural competency or fluency curriculum will end up with a school community that at least knows more about what the issues are and hopefully can say fewer things, do fewer things which frustrate or alienate young people of color.
Right. And I'm sure you know the opposition is, well, there are so few people of color here. Why do we all have to go through this? You know, why the opposition to those kind of cultural competency courses. But do you think it is a social obligation of a college or university to teach their students about diversity?
Well, here's the here's the practical problem that we all face. Let me illustrate from the wider culture. When we had the situation in Ferguson, the then Attorney General, Eric Holder, and the President of the United States, then Barack Obama, this conversation developed about how all black families, for instance, need to speak to young black men about being in American society.
Right, since Michael Brown had been shot, an unarmed black man.
All right. So what was interesting about that moment was that in public media, radio, television, there was a lot of follow-up conversation to the point about how people were surprised that black families found themselves still explicitly having these kinds of conversations. I was surprised that they were surprised that these kinds of conversations go on in the 21st century. I could not understand, well, I'll put it this way, where were other people living that they were not aware that America has not changed that much that you would not need to talk with young black men about what to do when you are stopped by the police?
Well, I think a lot of people, even seeing what happened in Charlottesville last week, were scratching their heads and saying, really, this is 2017? And I, you know, people who are not of color, I think in many ways have been oblivious.
Right. And I am, to a certain degree, sympathetic to that just for the practical reason that I think we know our own lived experience best. For instance, obviously, I am a man. I don't pretend to know the lived experience of a woman. But some of the testimony that I hear and have heard all my life lets me know that among the concerns that women have is for their own physical safety. And it's clear to me that if I were a woman, I would probably spend more time thinking about that than I think about it or have ever thought about it as a man. Therefore, it seems analogous to me that when I sometimes listen to majority culture talking, and I listen to the gaping spaces of ignorance that they have about the experiences of people of color and other underrepresented groups, I can get why they assume that we are living the same life, but we are not, and we have not been for centuries. And it is the fact that we've made some significant progress, let us say, over the last 60 years. People assume that we are all living the same life.
Yeah.
And that simply is not the case.
Well, we are now living in an era when extremist groups, when white nationalist groups have been arguably emboldened and are less secretive about their operations than they have been in years past. Is the onus upon private schools, public universities, and public schools to make students of color more comfortable?
There's been a very vibrant conversation going on online among teachers of all types. People who will be sitting down with kindergarten kids straight through graduate students about the way we need to engage our students about what we've been looking at in this last several days out of Charlottesville, what it says to us about the months that brought us here and the years that have brought us here, what our responsibilities are as educators to make sure that the body politic or that portion of it in front of us is able to carry on a careful, thoughtful, and open conversation about our responsibility as citizens. And yes, it would seem to me that any institution, public or private, that's dealing with young people has an onus upon it, a civic onus upon it, to try to help those students understand that the American story is more complex than the one that I was told when I was a kid. As a matter of fact, to go back to that period, quite frankly, the psychology of many black people certainly was that, well, there are many ways in which we are not center stage in the story that's being told here. I mean, we're there, but we're there in curious spots, occupying certain stereotypic roles. But over time, things hopefully will get better. I think that's what we were thinking 60 years ago, whenever it was. Today, particularly given the power of social media, the expectation is that all of us will put ourselves in touch with many aspects of that wider story. So a school, a university is not really in a position to ignore all of that information which is readily available to young people. An institution, particularly if it is going to invite a diverse population to it, needs to be about the business of helping people be decent human beings with each other in preparation for taking on the challenge of being a decent human being out in the broader society and world.
It sounds to me like a lot of adults could benefit from this kind of education as well.
Yes, and that's why these kinds of initiatives are not focused simply on students. The idea is not, well, let's deal with the incoming freshman class or let's deal. No, it's really it is an initiative for everyone at the institution, whether they're students or staff or faculty or whoever they are, whether they spend time in an office or whether they spend time in the boiler room, all members of the community could do well to open themselves to the understanding that all of us live more complex lives than may seem to be the case.
Russell, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Listen, thank you for the opportunity.
Russell Weatherspoon, he is an instructor in the religion department at Phillips Exeter Academy and has been there for more than 30 years. Special thanks today to All Eyes on UNH, Lekana Sok, Katie Thompson, and Angie Lane. We are working on a show for next week about another far less weighty but still surprisingly divisive issue. roundabouts. And we would love to hear from you. Are you pro or anti? Do you know the difference between a roundabout and a traffic circle? We have already heard from a number of folks sharing their favorite and least favorite New Hampshire roundabouts on our Facebook page. Take a look and chime in at facebook.com/wordofmouthradio. Big ups to Jimmy Gutierrez for today's show, which was also produced by Taylor Quimby, Logan Shannon, Molly Donahue, and Hannah McCarthy. Maureen McMurray is director of collegiate morale building and out of the cube thinking. Today's music from Broke for Free, Blue Dot Session, and Poddington Bear. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott, and stay tuned for Civics 101 coming up in just a minute.
Is the current Speaker of the House?
Don't even know.
Will they rule in the president's favor, or will they send it to the Supreme Court?
You can't refer to a senator directly by their name.
Congressional redistricting.
Separation of power.
Executive order.
The National Security Council.
Civics 101.
I'm Virginia Prescott, and this is Civics 101, the podcast refresher course on some of the basics that you may have forgotten or slept through in school. 44 people have become president of the United States, all men and with one exception, all white. Despite that historic profile and a clause in the Constitution, the qualifications outlining who can become president remain fuzzy. For instance, what does natural-born citizen really mean? And what about the residency requirement? Does it start anew every time you leave the country? Here to explain is our favorite presidential expert, Mr. Brady Carlson. He's author of the book Dead Presidents and All Things Considered, host at Wisconsin Public Radio. Hello, Brady.
Hello there.
Great to have you with us. So let's begin. What are the constitutional qualifications for becoming president?
Okay, there are three of them. And two of them are pretty straightforward. There's one that's pretty complicated. The first one is age. You have to be 35 years or older, and that is when you take office.
Oh, okay. So if Mark Zuckerberg, you know, if he's not just hanging out in Iowa because it's a lovely state, would he be eligible for a 2020 run at presidency? I think he's 33.
If he's 33 now, he would be fine as long as he turns 35 before Inauguration Day. So once you take that oath of office, you have to meet all of the qualifications.
So Inauguration Day, not Election Day.
Not Election Day, exactly. You can still be 34 on Election Day as long as your birthday's coming up.
Okay.
The second is a residency requirement. It says you have to be an inhabitant of the United States for 14 years or more. This is mostly a carryover from the early days of the country. They didn't want someone who maybe lived in the UK up until, you know, the Constitution was ratified, suddenly taking a boat trip across the Atlantic Ocean and then saying, hey, guys, I'm here. I'm going to be your new president. That said, though, there have been some questions about what exactly it means to be an inhabitant, because it's not entirely spelled out in the Constitution. It says you have to be an inhabitant for 14 years, but does that mean 14 years in a row? Does that mean 14 years over the course of your life? And just the word inhabitant itself can be interpreted in different ways. Does that mean that you're physically in the United States for up to 14 years? Or does it mean that you maintain a domicile, like you have a physical mailing address? There was a question in the 20th century about Herbert Hoover. He had worked overseas before he was elected president, and it was within that 14-year window. So if inhabitant meant 14 straight years of being in the United States ahead of being elected, he might have not been eligible to be president. That's obviously not what happened, though.
Okay, and number three?
Number three is the most complicated qualification, so I'm just going to read it right out of the Constitution. No person except a natural-born citizen or a citizen of the United States at the time of the adoption of this Constitution shall be eligible to the office of president. What it means to be a natural-born citizen is something that the courts have not entirely weighed in on, so it is definitely up to interpretation.
I remember this came up for the Texas Senator Ted Cruz, right?
I remember being at a primary event that he had in New Hampshire during the 2016 campaign, and a guy in the audience put it to him point blank. He said, Ted Cruz, you were born in Canada. To me, a person born in Canada is not a natural-born citizen of the United States, and therefore you're not eligible to be president. So here's the backstory. Ted Cruz was born in Canada. His mother was born in Delaware, so she was an American-born person. His father was born in Cuba. At that point, he was not a citizen of the United States, but he is now. They were working in Canada at the time, and so Ted Cruz said by virtue of having a mother who was an American citizen, he was a natural-born American. And the quote he gave was, "I have never breathed a breath of air when I wasn't an American citizen."
So Ted Cruz says that, but who's even in charge of determining whether or not he was a natural-born citizen?
Ultimately, it's a question that can be decided in the courts. Now, that's one that hasn't totally been decided in the courts. In Ted Cruz's case, there were several legal challenges to his candidacy. Most of those were turned away on procedural grounds. A few declared that basically that his explanation was good enough. But unless someone files a lawsuit against you, basically your word is good enough to get you qualified. But there have been other challenges over the years. John McCain, in fact, when he ran for president, faced some legal challenges because he was born in the Panama Canal Zone. He wasn't born in a state. Mitt Romney's dad, George Romney, when he ran for president in the 1960s, he was born in Mexico to American parents, and they both faced these same kinds of questions. Now, like I said, the U.S. Supreme Court hasn't taken this up. So the broad understanding up to this point is essentially if you're born in the United States, you're a natural-born citizen under the birthright citizenship in the 14th Amendment to the Constitution. If you're born in some other part of the world, but one of your parents, not both, but one of your parents is an American citizen, then you're still considered a natural-born citizen.
You gave us some more recent examples. Had this ever been challenged in the past when the United States was a real nation of immigrants and people were arriving on the shores, for decades?
My favorite story is the one when Chester A. Arthur became president. He was vice president under James Garfield and then moved up after Garfield died. He was born in rural Vermont, and some of his political enemies started a whisper campaign that maybe he was actually born in southern Canada rather than rural Vermont. Obviously, that didn't go too far either, but it's not a new thing for people to speak of their political opponents as the other or maybe not quite as American as other people are.
So, Brady, in a previous episode of Civics 101, we learned about U.S. territories. Could somebody who was born in a U.S. territory become president?
Well, that's a really interesting question because most of those who are born in U.S. territories are still considered American citizens, but not all. There are some of those territories where people are considered American nationals, but not technically American citizens. Would they be eligible to run for president if they were, say, from American Samoa? I'm not entirely sure. And we haven't had any American Samoan candidates for president that I know of, but it would certainly be an interesting legal question to bring up once we get to that point.
But Brady, how about things aside from those qualifications of age and domicile and whether or not you're a natural-born citizen? I mean, what kind of qualities tend to get people written off as serious presidential candidates?
Well, for the longest time, the unofficial qualifications were disqualifying much more people than any of those constitutional qualifications. I mean, for hundreds of years, it would have been considered ridiculous for a woman to be the nominee for a political party for the office of president of the United States. And people of color, same thing, or people who didn't have a background in politics and or the military. In some states, for a long time, they disqualified Catholics for running for anything. Religion was a disqualifying factor. It was considered that a white male Protestant was an unofficial but sort of universal qualification for president. And even today, you will hear questions. I remember during the primary campaign where people were saying that, you know, New Jersey Governor Chris Christie might be too fat to be president, never mind the fact that we've had overweight presidents in the past, that people felt obliged to weigh in on whether a person's physical attributes would disqualify them for president. Even if it doesn't say anything about that in the Constitution, it still came up.
So, okay, another question. If somebody is an incumbent president, do they automatically become the nominee for the next election cycle?
They do not. No guarantees. You gotta earn it. And in fact, nobody is a better case study for that than New Hampshire's only president, Franklin Pierce. He won election in 1852, and while it was common in those days for people to serve just one term, he had his eye on re-election. The only problem was he had made himself very unpopular in his own party, and so when the 1856 Democratic Party convention came around, He actually lost the nomination to another Democrat, James Buchanan. He sought the nomination. He wanted to get a second term, and they said thanks, but no thanks. So it's actually fairly common in U.S. history for incumbent presidents to face strong primary challenges. The incumbents usually win against those challenges. A great example of that was in 1976. That was when Gerald Ford was running for a full term, and he faced a very serious challenge in the Republican primary from former California Governor Ronald Reagan. They were separated by just a handful of delegates. Reagan very much could have won that nomination, but Ford was able to hold on.
So then, if incumbents usually win, then why do other people challenge them in primaries?
Because in politics, the usual rules for things don't always apply. In some ways, you can actually win by losing. An example of that was in 1992 when President George H.W. Bush was running for a second term, and he faced a primary challenge from conservative commentator Pat Buchanan. Now, Pat Buchanan wasn't going to win that race. He wasn't in a position to take the nomination away from a sitting president, but he was able to put up a strong enough showing, especially in the New Hampshire primary, that he was able to change the course of the Republican platform. He really wanted to have more socially conservative language in that platform, and was able to get some of that into the party platform for the year. Another example of that was in 1968 when Lyndon Johnson was looking to win another term, but Vietnam was a very controversial issue at the time, and some anti-war Democrats ran against him in the New Hampshire primary and actually did well enough that they convinced Johnson he couldn't win another term. So he actually got out of the race, which is kind of what they were aiming for. All of that said, though, once an incumbent gets into the general election, assuming that they do fend off all those primary challengers, they tend to do very well. There have been 22 times when an incumbent has won another term. They've only lost 10 times. Obviously, we don't know what's going to happen with President Trump in 2020, but the last three U.S. presidents in a row, Clinton, Bush, and Obama, have each won re-election. So incumbency is not a universal thing, but it is a very powerful thing.
So not everybody can become president, but incumbents have a pretty good shot.
Incumbents have a better shot than, say, a schlep like me.
But Brady, you have other qualities.
I have other qualities that get me on podcasts, I would say, but probably won't land me in the White House.
Brady Carlson, he's author of the book Dead Presidents. He's also All Things Considered host at Wisconsin Public Radio. And in the past, he worked right across from the office of our Civics 101 team. We miss him very much. Brady, thanks so much.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
That is it. Today's episode was produced by Molly Donahue and Logan Shannon. Music from Broke for Free. And if you're looking to drill more deeply into your understanding of civics, you can sign up for our weekly extra credit newsletter. It's a fast track to becoming the teacher's pet, with supplementary reading lists for the topics we covered and pop quizzes to see how much you've retained, and tips on how to remain an engaged citizen, all delivered to your email box. There's a link to sign up at civics101podcast.org. There you can also send us your questions about the fundamentals of democracy. And chances are good we'll use it for a future episode. I'm Virginia Prescott. Civics 101 is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.
This is the 10-Minute Writer's Workshop with Alice Fogel.
Alice Fogel has published 6 collections of poetry, including Interval, poems based on Bach's Goldberg variations, and most recently, A Doubtful House. She is currently Poet Laureate of New Hampshire, and one that former U.S. Poet Laureate Charles Simic called alert to every nuance of the inner life. I asked Alice Fogel which is harder, beginning a poem or finishing it.
I would say beginning it.
Just getting that first word, phrase, did they usually live in your head and you put them down?
I might grab them from different places, maybe my head, maybe a phrase I overheard or something that I read, maybe a word. But it's starting to put it together. That's the hard part.
And is it hard to get yourself to sit down, or do you have a regular schedule or ritual that you go through?
It depends what year you ask me.
Okay, how about this most recent book, A Doubtful House?
For A Doubtful House, I did pretty much have a weekly day that was put aside, or half a day that was put aside, and then I would work on it at other times during the week. But there was always that day.
And is it percolating while you're not writing?
Oh, definitely. There's always in the background or foreground even, there are things going on, and I'm always jotting things down on napkins and pieces of paper as they come to me.
So on that one day, do you have any ways that you kind of set up your writing space or, you know, music, candles, whatever, to totems?
I can write almost anywhere. Because I usually write in a journal, so I can take it outside if I want to, anywhere. I usually have a cup of tea. I have a Bic pen, like a really cheapo, plain old pen. I don't really require much. And usually if I'm inside, there will be music, something like Pat Metheny or Without Words.
What is your personal worst distraction from getting your work done?
Well, you know, there are, I like having many things that I try to avoid so that when I want to avoid one thing, I can do another. Sometimes when it seems like I could just sit down and write, it's really important to go clean the toilet bowl, which, of course, I would never want to do otherwise. So distractions are really just anything that I think I ought to do.
So writers must have the cleanest toilet bowls and the best flossed teeth. So how do you know when to walk away when it's not working?
Well, one of the things I think that I'm good at is not giving up. So, and this is something I think that I like to talk about this in workshops too, that we often walk away from our poems too soon. And it's okay to do that as long as you come back. But for me, it's just stay with it and stay with it and just keep changing phrases and words and keep rearranging it and keep adding and subtracting. And for me, that's a lot of fun.
Do you share it, your work, when you're working on it?
At some point.
When?
When I feel like it's beginning to really come together. Although there are times when I've done a poem a day challenge with a couple of poet friends, and we will have to send each other things by midnight. And so sometimes they're pretty raw.
You mentioned giving up. Are there other common mistakes that new writers make that you might caution them against? Things that maybe you did yourself?
Sure. There's loving some little thing in there too much. You know, it's the darlings that we're supposed to murder. getting attached to something that really maybe isn't the best for that poem.
Is there a piece or nugget of advice that you got about writing that you carry with you?
When I was in my 20s, I took a workshop with Galway Kinnell.
Wow.
Which was fantastic. And he said he would sometimes write many pages, pages and pages, that would then condense down into a half-page poem. And he said something like, write everything. Write everything you can think of that might go into this poem, and then just start peeling away and finding the core and the kernel.
Is there a book or a work that made you want to be a poet?
I wrote from the time I knew how. And even before that, I needed to record things. I used to sing myself to sleep as a little kid, and it was like a diary, like what I had done that day. So all the books that my parents had around the house, or the children's books that I had, all inspired me because I just wanted to make more of those and be part of that world.
What is on your nightstand now? What are you reading?
I'm reading The Hidden Life of Trees, which is awesome. And I have some poetry books there. I have Henry Walter's book. He's a New Hampshire poet.
Do you have a fantasy job other than writer?
A fantasy job? Mm-hmm. I've always wanted to be a neurosurgeon.
You'd have to work more than half a day a week.
Probably.
How about your worst advice about writing? Did anyone ever tell you anything that you just did not find useful at all?
I probably won't say what some of those things were, but the thing about that was important to me was in writing workshops when somebody would say, you can't do that, or don't do that, or this is how you have to do it. It took me a while to realize that that was really much more about that person and had nothing to do with what I was doing. And I needed to separate. I needed to make no rules for myself, and unless the rule needed to happen in the birthing of that particular poem.
Do you have a desert island book, Alice?
There's a really weird book that's probably very out of print called Heaven's Breath that I picked up in some bookshop once. And it's about wind and air, but it comes at it from every angle: science, psychology, art, spiritual aspects. It's just really an amazing book. So it would probably keep me company and keep me busy for a long time on a desert island.
I suppose all those elements would be really helpful. Under there with your one palm tree. Alice Vogel, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me.
Alice Vogel, whose most recent poetry collection is called A Doubtful House. The 10-Minute Writers Workshop is a production of NHPR, produced by Sarah Plourd and Taylor Quimby. If you like the 10-Minute Writers Workshop, head on over to Apple Podcasts and leave us a rating and a review, which helps spread the good word to other writerly and readerly folks. Until next time, thanks so much for listening.